You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life. So today it's asset allocation. What is asset allocation? It's just basically how we split our money up between different asset classes. We'll discuss why it matters, how we think about it, what the different options are. Sounds pretty straightforward enough, eh, Dave?
It should be, mate. We'll see how we go.
Yes.
All right, let's get started. So what exactly is asset allocation, and then also why does it matter? Well, in simple terms, asset allocation is really just the breakdown of how you have allocated your assets or your different investments, where you're parking your savings, essentially. Just a quick aside here, Pat, would you include home ownership in your asset allocation?
No.
No, I wouldn't really. I mean, you can look at it, I think, in terms of where your net worth is parked, if you want to look at it at a big picture level, but I wouldn't include it in like an asset allocation because I think of that more in terms of just investments only. What about you?
Yeah, I look at it the same way. Like for me, again, housing is an expense, right? So it's just an expense in Australian dollars. If I buy a house and it's worth $1 million, but then houses crash by 50% or they double by 100%, it doesn't matter to me because I can just sell a house and buy a house in the same market. So it doesn't affect my everyday life whatsoever.
And in retirement, it shouldn't affect your ability to produce a passive income because you're using it just to live in.
Yeah, my housing costs are completely hedged against the fact that I've bought a house. It's irrelevant to, like you said, our passive income and what we're spending and how much money we need our portfolio to produce.
Mm-hmm. So why does asset allocation matter? So our asset allocation will affect our long-term returns, and that obviously has the potential to affect how much we can earn from our investments over time to produce enough income to pay our expenses in early retirement. I think the real point of asset allocation and diversification in itself is to own some different assets to protect against things going wrong, because obviously if all your money is tied up into one type of investment and that investment produces a poor long-term outcome, that can affect your ability to remain retired for a long period of time.
Yeah, asset allocation is a lot about, you know, reducing risk, smoothing the ride out, and that's it really.
All right, so let's talk about where we might invest. So let's start with somewhere we are probably most familiar with, and that would be investing in Australia. So why might we want to invest in Australia, Pat?
So yeah, we often consider investing in Australia because we all live in Australia, or at least most of our listeners live in Australia.
It's kind of the natural first choice that pops onto your radar, isn't it?
Yeah, it was definitely the first choice that I thought of when I started investing near 8 years ago now, I think. And it's perfectly reasonable, I think, because you live in Australia, all your expenses are in Australia. So by investing in Australia, you are basically hedging the success of your portfolio to the success of Australia. So what that basically means is that if Australia does really well, then you're going to do really well in turn. And if the cost of goods go up in Australia by a lot, then your portfolio should also inflate a lot to match that. Yeah, just hedging yourself to the country that you live in.
And there's also, I guess if we're talking about Australian shares, there's also pretty generous tax benefits that come along with that. So people will be aware that with Australian property in Australia, we have negative gearing, which people like to think of as a pretty generous tax advantage of investing in property. with shares, we have franking credits, which is also a pretty advantageous system, which reduces the amount of tax owable on your dividends from Australian shares by quite a large amount, and in retirement even results in tax refunds, which is pretty handy, I'll say personally.
Are you enjoying some of those?
Yes, I love it, mate. Wow.
Oh man, I didn't even realize, didn't even click. Yeah, so people would say that franking credits are priced in. I mean, they are sort of partially priced in, but I think it's been shown that they're not fully priced in. So you do definitely still get a tax advantage by investing preferentially in Australian shares versus other markets. Of course, the third point we're going to make is that Australia isn't perfectly correlated with other world markets. So you do get a diversification benefit, which just basically means when other markets might be going down, Australia might be going up, and vice versa. When Australia's going down, other markets might be going up. So you can sort of choose which asset class you invest in or which asset class you pull your money out of by using that sort of zigzag motion.
And that can also help in slightly reducing the, I guess, the volatility of your portfolio. But the best long-term benefit, I think, is that it protects you from being totally reliant on just one type of investment, which in this case would be Australian shares.
Yeah, exactly.
So you might want to invest in Australia and Australian shares in particular because, I mean, Australia does have a lot of positive attributes. We're extremely stable and wealthy, developed country. We're very close proximity to Asia, which is growing a lot in the next, I don't know, 50 years or so. There's the tax advantages, like I mentioned. We're also very rich in resources here, and we have very good demographics as well. So there's a lot going for Australia. Just a bit of a side note, I personally feel more comfortable investing in developed countries as opposed to like emerging countries, like I guess you'd say China and India and some countries like that. And we'll get into a bit about international markets in a minute. But yeah, I'll just say that that's what I'm more comfortable with. And I think that kind of matters because you have to be confident in what you're investing in. And if you're not totally comfortable with where your dollars are invested, it's going to be harder. It's harder to stick with an asset that you don't totally believe in.
Yeah, definitely.
So I just wanted to chuck that in there.
Yeah, fair enough. I think unlike that, I'm perfectly comfortable investing in developing markets, say. Obviously, not a huge portion of my portfolio, but I see sort of that diversification benefit again, which is great. But I suppose that's a nice segue into the next sort of asset class, we'll call it, that Dave and I want to talk about. That's investing internationally. So global markets make up and they contain the largest companies in the world. Like, for example, the US has over 50% of the global world's market capitalization inside its share market, and the rest of the world makes up less than 50%. So,
and that's pretty crazy, right? Because if we go back roughly 100 years, the US was might be getting this wrong, but it was like 10 to 20%. Does that sound right?
Oh, was it? I don't know. It was much smaller.
Yeah, it was much smaller. I think the UK was the biggest market back then.
Yeah. And there was a period of time where Japan became the biggest market.
Yes.
But that just goes to show the diversification benefit of international investing. Like, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. You don't want to put all your eggs in like what's currently the biggest market, because they might not always be the biggest market. And you just want to spread it like sort of far and wide, get that benefit of diversifying.
And if you compare that to Australia is about 2 or 3% of the world's market, and that's because we're obviously a very small country compared to the likes of America.
Yeah, exactly. And being only 2 to 3%, you can kind of understand why people think it's a bit unusual or a bit crazy to invest everything in the Australian market, because especially now when it's so easy to invest internationally, like we have all these ETF options available to us, with Australia only being 2 to 3%, why wouldn't you take advantage of the easy access to international markets?
It's definitely never been easier or cheaper to do that.
Oh, it's great. It's unbelievable. By owning global shares, you get sort of exposure to different industries and different companies which aren't available in Australia. The first example that really comes to mind is the tech giants in the USA. Like, in Australia, we just have nothing that compares in the tech industry.
Not nowhere near the level of dominance that that those kind of companies have.
No, not even close. So like if you really want exposure to world tech, you have to do it outside Australia. Also not just tech, but other like multinational consumer brands like McDonald's, Starbucks, big healthcare conglomerates. Like we have a big one here, CSL, but there are definitely others around the world. Mm. There is like Bayer and stuff.
Yeah, and that's not to say you want to like load up on tech or load up on a certain, I guess, theme in particular. It's more about, I think, those kind of industries that, for example, the US has. If you look at the industry makeup, it really complements what we have here in Australia, because they have a lot of technology, we have a lot of resources. So there's, if you blend those two together, it kind of has a better combination, because we don't really have access to the types of industries and companies, obviously, that are over there.
Doesn't have to be just the US either. Like there's plenty of other, I think, there's 23 developed countries around the world or something along those lines.
Yeah, that sounds right.
You can easily get access to all those, and a nice developed international fund complements the Australian fund really, really nicely.
Having said that, how would we go about combining the two of these together? And so I guess it really depends on your purpose for investing internationally. Some people will be maybe like myself who are investing internationally, mostly as a long-term way to protect against the risk that Australia does really poorly over my lifetime, say. So that's my main reason for investing internationally, and obviously to gain access to companies and industries that we don't really have much of here in Australia. So it's more like a complementary effect that I'm going for there. Having said that, there's really three common options that I tend to see people going for when trying to combine the two of international shares and Australian shares. And so we'll go through those now.
Yeah, so firstly, a lot of people think that it's just go for a complete replication of market capitalization. So they essentially invest in a global, well-developed fund and maybe an emerging markets fund, roughly 90-10. And Australia is so small, like 2 to 3%, they just don't even bother with it. Like it's more of a hassle than it's worth to get 2% of your portfolio into an Australian shares fund.
And so to kind of flesh that out, what you're saying is that some people will start with, I guess, the assumption or the decision to like, okay, what's the current breakup of the entire share market of the whole world? I'm going to just copy that replication, because they're going to make the connection. Okay, I want most of my money in the biggest market and then the next amount in the next biggest market and so on.
Yeah, correct. And with just the products available in Australia, sometimes it's easier just to leave Australia out, ironically, if that is the initial assumption you're going with.
Mm. Because you don't want a holding, you don't want to have a separate fund or holding that's maybe like 2% or 3%. Yeah. Well, if something's that small as part of your portfolio, it's whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It's probably not going to make a big difference at all to your long-term.
Yeah, exactly.
Returns.
Yeah. I don't know. Should we just dive a little deeper into that? So in Australia, you can buy, say, an Australian shares fund and an international developed markets fund minus ex-Australia, which means the international fund doesn't include any Australian shares. And you can also buy an emerging markets fund. Like I said, if you start with the assumption that you want to copy market capitalization around the world, you can just get the international fund and the emerging markets fund. And if you're going to be strict about it, get the Australian share fund too, as 2% of your portfolio. But at 2%, why bother? Like, it's just so small, it's too much of a hassle.
Yeah, that's a good way to explain it. And so the next option, it's the bucket that I fall into, really, and that's to invest a fair bit in Australia, maybe 50% or more of your wealth, and invest in international shares as more of like an insurance plan or a backup plan in the odd chance that Australia does really poorly over the next 30 years or so. So that's really the bucket that I fall into. Like I feel pretty, I guess, comfortable and confident in the future of Australia. So I'm happy to invest a pretty big chunk of my money here, and the risk of Australia turning to crap in the next few decades doesn't really concern me at all. But it's a possibility, right? So that's why I'm investing also a decent chunk of my money in international shares. And at the moment, it's about 20%, but I'll probably increase it a bit over time, and we'll probably talk a little bit about that later. But that's roughly the next bucket of people. And the third bucket is people who invest heavily in global shares, not as much as the first people, which was 100%, but they also invest in Aussie shares for the tax advantages, like we mentioned before, and also to have some Aussie dollar assets, because you'll be spending your money in Aussie dollars in retirement, obviously. So you might have maybe a 20 to 40% allocation to Australian shares. And this is roughly what super funds tend to do, and institutional investors like that. And Pat, I think you're more in this bucket than the other two.
Yeah, this is almost the perfect description of what I do. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so if you, as we just mentioned here, if you choose to invest a lot of money outside Australia, say most of your wealth, you obviously have to be mindful of currency risk, because all your investments will be based in other currencies. So you'll really need to think about having some investments in hedged products. I was going to say hedged funds, but it sounds like I'm saying hedge funds.
No, that's right. And just to be clear, like, I think sometimes currency has been shown to reduce, like, volatility a bit. Like, having some of that currency exposure can actually be advantageous. But by the same token, like you said, at other times, it isn't advantageous. And so it does pay to have a bit of hedged exposure as well.
Because you want, I guess, if you're thinking about living off this portfolio someday, your expenses are going to be in Aussie dollars, so you need to be creating an income stream that is a fair bit tied to the Aussie dollar.
So exactly.
To protect your purchasing power in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the risk there is that the Australian dollar strengthens a lot. And when the Australian dollar strengthens, the value of your international portfolio in Australian dollars decreases. Mm. But again, that can also happen the other way around. If the Australian dollar weakens or international currencies strengthen, then that would mean that the value of your international shares or international holdings increases in Australian dollars.
If we think about like what happened this year in times of crises, the Aussie dollar tends to fall. And if you own international shares, when the Aussie dollar goes down, those international shares will be worth more in Aussie dollars.
Yeah, correct.
Say the Aussie market and the international market both fall at the same time, but the Aussie dollar also falls, your international shares will hold up much better than your Australian shares. And so if you have a blend of the two, your portfolio won't fall anywhere near as much for that reason, because of the currency benefit there.
Thank you. That was a very clear way to explain it. That was good. I just kind of stumbled around it a bit. But
well, it's kind of, they're not easy topics to kind of get your head around really at first, because you've got multiple things moving in different directions at the same time. So
yeah, exactly.
It's easy to get, I guess, tongue-tied or a bit confused thinking about it, especially on the spot.
Yeah, on the spot. But I mean, the takeaway is, if you're going to invest in Australian shares and heavily into international shares, you may want to consider part of that investment in international shares being hedged.
And there is special products that are ETFs that are essentially exactly the same thing, international shares index fund. It's just hedged it to Aussie dollars and only costs slightly more in terms of the fee of that fund, but other than that, it's exactly the same thing. You might have guessed it by now, but the options are really endless when it comes to kind of blending your portfolio, putting it together. I think Pat and I would both agree, like, although we're approaching it a bit differently, there isn't really a perfect answer to this. You really have to think about it for yourself and decide what you feel most comfortable with and what risks you want to protect against for your portfolio in the long term.
Yeah, definitely.
You would have seen this study by Vanguard, Pat, that showed that they matched Aussie and international shares together and tried to look for the lowest
volatility.
Volatility portfolio, and I think the result was somewhere around 50-50.
Yeah, I think that was roughly correct. Yeah, I think I remember seeing that.
And then you've got prepackaged options like the Vanguard High Growth Index Fund. That one invests roughly 35 to 40% in Australian shares, and the rest is pretty much all international shares. And there's also a 10% amount that's allocated to bonds and cash. And it comes at pretty reasonable cost at like less than 0.3%. So that's not too bad an option. And I guess the benefit with that is you don't have to decide for yourself. It's already been decided for you. You just invest in one fund and that's it. So it's about as simple as it could get.
Yeah, someone's thought about it all and they've done the research and they know what they're doing. So they kind of make a pretty good default fund for the vast majority of people.
Especially for people who have absolutely no interest in this stuff. They're just like, just give me one fund and I'll just put my money in there and that's it.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably more people than we think, Pat.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, just think about like any of your family who are like kind of interested in investing. Imagine trying to give them four or five funds to juggle.
Yeah,
like never work. Like, here, just put your money in this is this will do well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of behavioral tricks and traps, I guess, to be aware of when you're investing. And if you make things too hard, people are just unlikely to do it at all. So you want to things as easy and simple and as comfortable as you can for people because they're way more likely to be engaged and actually do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So how about some other investments? Like we've talked a bit about shares and international shares.
It's funny. We just assumed that people were going to invest in shares. We shouldn't have assumed that at all, should we? It's Australia.
No, you're right.
I'd say, obviously, people love to invest in property in Australia. So if you were going to do that, or you might have already done it, you'll definitely want to include that as part of your asset allocation. And you want to consider how big, if you think about like a pie chart or a piece of pie, how big do you want the piece of pie, property pie, to be as a percentage of your whole pie? And what kind of level are you going to be comfortable with that?
Yeah.
Because if you have half your portfolio in maybe investment property and you only have two investment properties, you've got each investment property is a quarter of your entire portfolio. So you have to consider whether you're comfortable with that. Maybe you are, but that's that would be up to you. And then if you already have them, do you plan to, I guess, pay them off and keep them long term as asset that's going to provide you income in retirement? Or do you plan to just sell it later and hopefully it's had some capital growth and then put the money into shares to create your income stream? You'll have to consider that one.
Yeah. And like leverage can really blow this out. Like you could all of a sudden have like 70, 80% of your entire net worth tied up in a single investment property. And that's... That makes me uncomfortable, but a lot of people seem to be very comfortable with that. So. Yeah,
I guess it depends. It kind of comes back to the Australia thing and the diversification thing. How comfortable are you with the prosperity of Australia? Because if Australia continues to do just fine over the next 10 or 20 years, it's a reasonable assumption or a bet that Australian property will probably do just fine as well. But then obviously there is a risk that that doesn't happen. So that's for people to consider.
Yeah, but it's like, it's not property. It's one property. If you've invested in like your previous example, two houses, we're talking about like single house risk. Stripper joint opens up down the road and all of a sudden...
In a residential neighborhood.
Look, I don't know. I'm just making things up, you know, like, oh, there was termites that weren't picked up on the building and inspection report or something. Or like there's some localized flooding in the area. I suppose you can see flood maps for that sort of thing. But it's just, I'm saying known risks. There might be some unknown risks. Yeah. And it's not really apparent how to easily diversify a property portfolio from those idiosyncratic single property sort of risks.
Yeah, there's an easy solution, mate. You just buy more and more property in different
Well, yeah, eventually, yeah, that is the solution, but yeah, that takes time.
You'll get there.
Yeah, I'll get there. Yeah.
So like I said before, you have to consider how many properties you want to keep long term and the risks involved, like Pat said, involved with one or two or three particular assets. I'm deciding that I'm going to keep none long term and I'm going to have all of the proceeds from our properties after they're sold to be put into our share portfolio because, like I've said before, there's too many costs and there's too many kind of hassles involved and I just don't want to deal with that stuff, you know? And even if they're paid off in Australia, after all their expenses are accounted for, the income is actually pretty crap. If you are thinking that you're going to get a pretty handsome rental income stream, you might be a little bit disappointed once all the bits and pieces are accounted for.
I think you went through some of those costs in a previous episode. Yeah.
I think so.
And I'm in the same camp. I think I'll have no investment properties in my portfolio. So,
all right. So let's move on to maybe a less exciting asset class, which is bonds and cash. You'll probably also want to keep a certain amount of money in cash and bonds in retirement. And that would be either to smooth out the volatility of your portfolio when you're actually living on it and taking money from it, whether it's, you know, through dividends and selling shares and whatever it is, or as a bit of a backup plan. In case the worst case scenario happens, it's always a good idea to have some cash and some so-called safe assets on hand if you need it. And so this again is a personal choice how much you choose to keep sitting around in cash. I think we both, me and you, Pat, probably have a fairly high risk tolerance and we're pretty flexible spenders and we don't have a high level of spending. So we don't tend to keep a lot of cash around and we'd probably lean towards keeping less as possible while still kind of maintaining some flexibility and cash for true emergencies and whatever. What do you think?
Yeah. Especially during accumulation, I've essentially got a zero cash position, except what I'm sort of put aside for a house deposit. Otherwise, I have like a zero cash position. And during retirement or financial independence, like you said, it'll still be a pretty small amount by all standards. It won't be zero, but it'll be a small amount.
Maybe like 5% or 10% at the absolute most.
Yeah, 5 to 10 is about the range I'm looking at. Yeah.
And so what about some other more exciting assets, Pat, like gold and crypto and stuff like that? What about that? Where should that fit in our asset allocation?
Oh, you just had to throw that in there, right? You're just trying to get me riled up. Oh, man, how many clock cycles am I going to have to waste on this shit?
What do you think is reasonable? You know, like 20% for gold and 20% for crypto? Is that reasonable?
Oh, man, you know, you should keep it all in crypto because it's going to go to the moon.
But what if it doesn't? So you need some gold just in case.
Oh, that's right. The gold balances out.
It's called diversification, mate. Come on.
Yeah. Precious metals. Just gold, though? Shouldn't we diversify amongst precious metals?
Gold's the king of metals.
Oh, okay. I have no idea. If it wasn't obvious, I think both Dave and I don't really see the value in a cryptocurrency or gold position in your investment portfolio.
But some people do.
Some people do. You can look into it yourself. I think it's a waste of time.
Tell us what you really think. I'd say if you feel like you really want to allocate some money to this type of area, just make it like a small amount. That's the best I could do for
you're kinder than I am.
And then so what about other things like stock picking? Because it's not a separate asset class, but someone might want to have, say, a small, I just gave away the answer, but a part of their portfolio set up for stock picking and stuff like that. Or whether it's out of interest or whether they genuinely think they can do a good job at it or whatever, as a hobby. Or there might be a lot of reasons that they might get into it, but they might just have that itch that they want to scratch.
Well, I don't see that as an investment. I just see that as expenditure then. Like, not part of your investment portfolio if you're doing it for fun, right?
Well, it's multiple purpose, isn't it? No?
Again, you're kinder than I am. Feel like, oh, just use a little bit of your portfolio to do it, to scratch the itch. And I'm just like, nah. Oh, you want to do it? Whatever. Do what you want. It's your money. But you're not going to get me to say that it's an okay or a good idea to do it as an investment.
Yeah, I'm not going to recommend it, but if people want to do it and have that urge, they're probably going to do it anyway. So if they're going to do it, just keep it as a small percentage of your portfolio. I'd say like 5% or less. Yeah.
I've always considered like that sort of line of thinking to be the same as like how we all like drink alcohol. Like we all know it's not great for us, right? Do you drink?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, occasionally. Yeah. Like, I know drinking alcohol is not great for me, but I do it. But you're never going to...
You just make it a... You're never going to make it a small part of your lifestyle, see?
Yeah. But you're never... I'm never going to go to, like, a nutritionist or a doctor and be like, is this good for me? Can I make this as part of my health plan? They'll say, look, whatever. It's not going to kill you, but they're not going to recommend alcohol as part of the food.
No, of course. They're just going to say, keep it reasonable, keep it modest.
Yeah. Have fun. Do what you want, but it's not part of your investment.
So that's really what we're saying here. So let's talk a little bit more about, so why is diversification useful on the journey to and during financial independence? Like I said before, if you invest everything into Australia or any market in particular, that market may underperform or that asset class may underperform over the long term, and it may actually have pretty crap results just based on bad luck or maybe poor economic management of the country or the companies that are in that country do poorly. Could be a lot of reasons that happens. That's definitely a possibility. So the real benefit of diversification, I think, is to protect against that risk by having at least some of your money invested in a different asset class, or if not a different asset class, different markets, which will help protect against that risk because you're not overly reliant on one industry or one country or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Another benefit is that, so what Dave was sort of describing was like long-term country goes to hell sort of scenario. Mm. Like it's just, everyone uses the Japan example. I think from 1990 to currently it's made like
4% a year or something.
Crappy returns. Oh, even that might be a bit too generous. Yeah, okay. I think it was even less. So that's sort of like disaster scenario. But even in not disaster scenarios, sometimes some markets do better than others. For example, from 2000 to 2010, international markets did better than the US market. But then from 2010 to 2020, the US market just absolutely demolished other international developed country markets.
If you look at returns from 2000 to 2010, the US market, I think, went down by like 5% per year because there was two crashes in that period. The returns were absolutely atrocious.
Yeah, but other markets did all right. But if you held some US shares, some other international market shares, you know, you wouldn't have done too bad during that time because you could have drawn upon the international shares that were doing better than the US market shares.
And also another thing that sometimes is important, that it also helps FOMO to some extent. Like if you're just investing in one investment or in one market, and then this other investment or this other market is doing extremely well for a long period of time, people inevitably feel like they're missing out. And so it can lead them to kind of thinking about jumping ship and moving from one investment to the other to try and catch the wave sort of thing, which is obviously a bad idea. But if you own multiple, the idea, I guess, is if you own multiple assets on multiple investments, you're going to benefit from the growth of both. Whichever one ends up doing better, you will own a slice of that as well. So it does protect against FOMO a little bit.
It definitely does. No, you're not wrong. And like you said, you want to be able to pick something that you can stick long term with and not have the urge to mess around or jump around. Something else we probably want to talk about is ways to structure your investments. So some people set up the same or different portfolios inside and outside of super. Personally, I aim for exactly the same portfolios in and out of super. I don't try and pivot some markets or some asset classes to one or the other. But I definitely know that it is quite popular to try and do that. So some people would put their higher yielding portfolios inside their superannuation account because super is a better tax environment. So overall, they should get taxed less if they put their higher yield, say Australian shares inside super and international shares outside super, because international shares are more yielding.
But you know that
doesn't actually
work like that.
Well, go on.
People say that, right? And it works if there was no tax advantages for Australian shares, but there is. So it doesn't work like that. The tax you end up paying on Australian shares often works out being like roughly the same or less than the tax you'll pay on the dividends from international shares, because it's not like you're not getting any dividends from international shares. You are, and they are fully taxable.
No, you're right, yeah.
So you end up losing the same or more on those dividends, even though they come with a lower dividend yield. So I really get puzzled at why people, because people just make the assumption that, well, this one has a higher yield, so I better put it in super. Because of the franking credits, you end up more tax advantaged. Wherever Australian shares go, they're more tax efficient.
Yeah, so okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, you get the benefit of the franking credits inside or outside of super.
The tax drag is less either way.
Shares. Yeah.
Less than international shares in most cases.
No, fair enough. I think it also sort of depends on how much the franking credits are priced in to the price movements. Kind of, we have some good estimates, but
that's a different conversation from tax drag, which is usually what people are focusing on when they're talking about where to put investments.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Well, I mean, it is. It depends on whether you think that Australian shares yield 4% or they yield 5.7%. Like, in your mind, they yield 4%.
Yeah, it depends how you want to look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing with a lot of things like this. It depends how you want to look at it. So there's no, like, perfect answer to almost... You could debate almost every investing question and there's almost no perfect answer because it depends how you look at it.
Sometimes, yeah. Also, like, there's another thing to consider here, and that is, like, inside super, after you retire, you may actually be paying more tax inside super than you would on your marginal tax rate, especially after you've already retired. And if you've got a partner that you're sharing the portfolio with, because you get your first $18,200 in income tax-free.
It's about $20,000 if you include the tax offsets.
Yeah, exactly. So you can potentially, you and your partner could potentially earn $40,000 in income and pay no tax. Whereas if those investments were in super, you'd pay 15% tax on the very first dollar of income that they get.
Yeah, and you'd be getting franking refunds completely refunded franking credits.
Correct. Yeah. So it's not as simple as, oh, this is the most tax efficient and this is the least tax efficient. You actually have to look at it across the scope of your whole life and how long you're going to be in retirement phase, how long before you access your super, what's the best mix. And it just becomes, it becomes a wash, honestly. Like, it becomes like you're tinkering too much. There's too many unknowns. You can sort of pivot it a bit to make it more efficient right now, but then it'll sort of flip once you get into retirement phase and you can access that stuff from super.
Yeah. So I think saying put this investment here because it's less tax efficient, whatever, that's kind of a lazy answer.
Oh, it's an extremely lazy answer.
It's convenient, but it's pretty lazy.
That's true. And it doesn't take into account people's differing life circumstances.
Even in retirement and early retirement, your shares, whether they're Australian shares, international shares, whatever they are, they will be incredibly tax efficient because, as Pat just said, you can earn, if you're a couple, you can earn roughly $40,000 of income per year and pay zero tax. You'll have your franking credits refunded. You'll also, if you're selling, trimming your international shares to create some income, you also get capital gains discount on the profit that you've made when you're selling those shares. And so tax is, we'll probably do an episode about tax, but it is just definitely not a long-term concern for early retirees or those who aspire to, you know, be financially independent.
It's so not a concern.
Because of that, don't overthink it and try to optimize your investments for tax, because your tax rate will change over time, especially once you've reached financial independence.
Yep.
And so maybe, let's say you retire, right? You might not earn any income for a while and you just live on your investments, which is fine. But then maybe you suddenly start working or you get a big spike in income for some reason. If you had all these plans perfectly laid out based on how much tax you were trying to pay and, you know, trying to reduce the amount of tax, that'll just be blown out of the water because you've started earning some money and you have to, I've got to reshuffle things now and move some stuff around.
Yeah,
so you're just trying to play this game, you know, this tax game.
Yeah.
And you end up, I guess, wanting to adjust your investments and switch them around just to try and save tax or pay as little tax as possible, which is generally a pretty bad idea.
Yeah. No, agreed. There's too many unknowns to be able to pull it off as efficiently as possible. So, I mean, that's why I just mimic my out of super allocation inside super and call it a day. So our own approach to asset allocation, Dave, we probably want to share what we do. Do you want to go first or?
Yeah, all right, let's go. So following on from the last bit, we're in our early retirement kind of phase at the moment. And so we've got, I say, most of our wealth invested in Australian assets, roughly 80%. At the moment, and that's comprised of like Australian shares, but also Australian property. But as mentioned, we'll be selling those over time. Our personal portfolio is almost all Australian shares at the moment. There is some international shares that will be getting a bit bigger over time, but it's mostly Australian shares on the shares side. And our super is set up as 100% international shares, and that makes up about 20% of our wealth at the moment. And the reason I structure it like that is kind of what I said earlier in the podcast, which is I really see international diversification in our scenario as serving like a long-term risk mitigation purpose that Australia, for some reason, does really, really poorly over the next few decades. And so if our investments really turn to crap, then by the time, in a couple of decades, we'll have a pretty substantial or pretty decent amount of international shares that we can start drawing on, which would have grown a fair bit because it's obviously been untouched for quite a while. So even though we're not, you know, working full time and still putting money into it, it's still compounding in the background. And so that diversification is also increasing in the background because it's just being left untouched to grow.
Mm.
Our diversification is kind of increasing without really doing anything at the moment. And so if I had to summarize my stance on it, I think like I've become more keen on diversification over time to get access to like other companies and industries that we don't have as much of here in Australia. And it really complements, I think, Australian shares by owning international as well. But I think a lot of the like people get really fearful around it and think that they're going to somehow run out of money, and I just don't have that same level of fear factor that I need to invest a massive amount of money overseas to protect against the risk of running out of money, I'll say. Maybe I'm just a bit more relaxed about that, but I don't have that desire to have maximum protection against every possible risk I'd say.
Yeah.
Like, we're in early retirement, I guess. So I like the higher income and the franking credits from Australian shares, which is extremely handy for us. Like I said, we're getting the tax refunds. I just find it very convenient and I guess an enjoyable way to invest, where I'm getting a pretty decent income stream. And then also because we have a lot of Australian investments, we don't really need to think about hedging because most of our investments are in Aussie dollars. So that kind of makes it simpler as well. The last point I'd make is that I personally think that Australia is one of the best, better places to invest, because if you look at around the world at a time of zero interest rates, there's not many places in the world where you can invest in like good assets like shares or commercial property and that, and get pretty healthy income streams in a stable and developed country. There's not many other places that have those kind of attributes. So I feel pretty good about Australia and having a healthy or good portion of my assets invested in Australian investments, I'll say. So what about you, Pat? What's your approach?
Yeah, so like we touched upon earlier, I'm mostly in international shares. So I think currently I'm about 70% developed markets, and I've only got 20% in Australian shares, with the remainder made up of emerging markets. And of course, because like you just said, because my Australian portion makes up such a small amount, I do hedge some of the international back into Australian dollars. I just think, why not, basically? I do have a bit of home bias for some of the reasons I listed before, but it's so easy and there's absolutely, I think, no downside to diversifying. In the investment world, it's called the only free lunch, so why not? I just go out, I've got all of those buckets. And I suppose when I do finally pull the trigger on retirement, I will add some safe assets to it. And that'll probably, I've been thinking a bit about this, it'll probably be in the form of just additional money in an offset account. And that'll be like my safe bucket.
Ours is roughly the same approach, just having cash in an offset account.
Yeah, that makes the most sense if you've got debt to offset that debt instead of become a creditor to the Australian government. So
yeah. Your return's going to be higher as well.
It's higher and it's not taxed. Like, it's just, and it's instantly available. Yeah. So there's no reason not to, I think.
Not many countries have offset accounts.
Really?
Australia is one of the only countries that does it.
That's weird.
It's pretty cool, hey?
Yeah, that's great.
It's like, it's got to be one of the best inventions in the finance world.
Yeah, but I think in other countries, they have like fixed rate mortgages. Like, they're fixed for the entire length of the mortgage.
Like 30-year fixed in the US, they have.
30-year fixed.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. We don't know.
Imagine if you could get a 30-year fixed right now.
Yeah, for 2%.
For 2%. Like, you'd jump on that.
Yeah. So I guess swings and roundabouts, hey, we don't have that.
Yeah, exactly. Swings and roundabouts.
And so probably the last thing here we want to say is that we kind of implied it before, but don't choose your investment assets based on recent performance, because like we mentioned, things go in cycles. So you'll find that one market will outperform for one decade, and then other markets will outperform the next decade, while one, obviously it doesn't work on 10-year periods, but you know, these things go in cycles. So each different regions will take turns at performing at different levels, I guess.
Yeah. And that's one of the primary benefits of diversification. It's holding it all so that when one's not doing well, others are doing well to take the slack.
Because one country or one region is not going to outperform forever. Everywhere has their, I guess you could call it summer and winter periods.
Yep. So takeaways from this episode. You know, really consider how diversified you are and whether you're comfortable with that over the next few decades. And I suppose that's key. You have to think about it over decades, because the last thing you want to be doing is churning through your portfolio by selling and buying. So try and set something up that you'd be able to live with over the very long term.
I guess we didn't mention it, Pat, but we should note here that this is something that you want to just make a long-term decision based on. It's not like, okay, I'm going to allocate X amount this year, and then next year I'm going to change it because I think this area is going to do better. It's definitely, you definitely don't want to approach it like that, or we wouldn't recommend it anyway. You want to have something as a long-term target that you want to work towards, not something that you're going to change and evaluate every year. I mean, you can change over time as you learn more or your risk comfort tolerance levels changed.
Yeah,
but it's not something that you want to tactically change to try and juice your returns, because it's not that easy.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. And I suppose don't stress too much about getting it right or perfect, because there really is no perfect portfolio. Dave and I, our views have both changed as the years have gone by. And as your risk tolerance and your views change, you can definitely, you know, start steering your portfolio to a new asset allocation over time. Hmm. And that's perfectly fine as well.
And I just want to add something in here that I think people forget. A lot of, like, we're focused on risk and building wealth and all the rest of it and protecting against the chance that we run out of money for whatever reason. But I don't know about you, but I think the FIRE crowd is probably the most well-equipped segment of the population to deal with long-term risks like this. And they're more diversified than almost anybody else because they usually have a lot of different sources of wealth and income. So they'll have their job. They might not keep that forever, but they have the ability to earn income. They'll have their house, which is obviously a store of wealth. They'll have their super. They'll have shares in hundreds or even thousands of businesses. And they might even have investment properties and cash and whatever. So, and then when they hit retirement, they'll probably start earning some income from like a part-time job or a hobby or a business they start. So there's just so many different aspects of wealth and income that I just don't think there's much fear that needs to be held around long-term risks of people in this kind of community having long-term financial problems. I just think that there's no need to stress yourself out about it. And remember, like, most of us are pretty flexible with our spending as well. And then we've also got pretty healthy social safety nets in Australia as well, should the worst case scenario ever happen. So yeah, I don't think anybody's going to go hungry.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point. Like, you're right. We're sort of picking away at the edges here when in all likelihood we are extremely more diversified than the vast majority of people. And even just having this level of savings and cash at all puts you in a much, much safer position than a lot of people.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the areas of life where like the 80-20 rule applies. Like, a few key decisions will drive the majority of your results. And so I think, obviously, as we've mentioned before, that just the habit of saving and investing regularly, you know, month after month, as you can afford to, into low-cost investments is obviously your first key pillar that will drive results. And the second one would be to get some level of diversification to other countries or other markets. That will be another driver that will be kind of a key pillar to your long-term results. And so the rest of it is a lot of details and a lot of noise, but those are the two key things that I think will drive the results in the long term.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And they're actually both very simple and easy to do.
Doesn't get any easier than that.
Job done. Podcast over.
Well, spent a whole hour just talking when we could have just said diversify and save. Done. Let's go.
All right. Next episode will be 5 minutes because we'll just cut right to the takeaway.
Yeah, that'll be a fun episode to listen to.
All right, so we hope we've given you some food for thought here. Is there anything else you want to add there, Pat?
No, nothing at all.
All good? All right. Thanks for listening to today's episode, guys. If you did and you enjoyed it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can send any feedback or questions you have to us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com. And you can find more from us at our blogs, strongmoneyaustralia.com and lifelongshuffle.com. We'll see you next time.